Between a rock and a prostitute. It's quite an awkward place to be in, especially for a man who walked this earth over 2,000 years ago named Jesus. Now in John 8:2-16, Jesus encounters a trap set by the Pharisees. He was presented with a prostitute who was caught in the act. Now, according to Mosaic law, she had to be put to death for her sin. Now, Jesus was seemingly unaffected by this and just kind of starts going over and starts drawing in the sand. Now, all of the Pharisees are kind of wondering what on earth is going on. And they begin to heckle him. And soon he becomes and pops back up and goes, "Well, hey, if you're without sin, you can start throwing rocks." So he goes back down, and pretty soon everyone starts to leave because they realize that Jesus is the only one qualified to actually do the job. Now, when Jesus straightened back up, he said, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" Now, that's kind of a little bit awkward, and Jesus wasn't so suave with the ladies on that one. But he does make an interesting point. When it comes to prostitution and prostitutes, many of us never think about what is behind prostitution. The fundamental question in this story is, who is the true sinner? Is it the Pharisees who are economically lavished and doing the work of God, or is it the prostitute who is being enslaved by the practices of the Pharisees? So in today's global economy, how we earn and spend our finances becomes important as it affects an exponential amount of other human beings on the face of the earth. For all prostitutes, their wage-earning profession stems out of survival and economics. When we were asked in kindergarten what you wanted to be when you grew up, none of us raised our hands and went, "I want to be a prostitute." But too often, the policies set forth by few that affect the many make this a sad reality. As people of the church and of privilege, the way we earn wealth and spend our finances influences the lives of people around us. Inequitability and sustainability breeds hostility and violence. When people's basic needs aren't met, they either shut down or they fight. When working towards peace, we need to fundamentally work within the context of economic accountability, social diversity, and restorative justice working together in a global framework. Now, from the parable of the sower to the parable of the hidden treasure and the pearl, over 13 of Jesus' parables are on monetary economics. Jesus clearly realized how much of a role economics played in peace, since economics are simple, based on humans' will to survive. And it's at the heart of all peace and war and violence. The woman with Jesus could have been suffering from what theologian Robert Brawley would say is an economic sin. Brawley says in Biblical Ethics that accepting gifts from unjust sources, extortion, withholding wages, oppressing the poor, on and on and on down to prostitution, are all economic sins. All are tied together through the intricate web of monetary economics. For the prostitute in the story, she is very similar to prostitutes in Asian countries today. For poorly educated women in Asia, many of them have no other choice than to either stay in their native area and be killed and not have any wage-earning potential besides working in the fields, or leave to the city for prostitution. Being denied freedom through economics is its own kind of hell. In today's economic crisis, more and more men and women are turning to the military just to earn a wage and supply their family with their needs. Because of our wage-earning practices that we are forcing on people, we actually force them to make decisions against their will. But so what? What do prostitutes halfway on the other side of the earth and the neighbor next door have to do with you and my wallet? Well, every day we put our money where our mouth is, and it unconsciously speaks curses. A landowner went out early in the morning one day and hired men to work in his vineyard all day. When the end of the day came, he paid the workers one denarius, or about one day's sustenance. The workers who were hired in the early morning began to grumble because they saw that they deserved more. but how much do you need? They had received their living amount, how much they needed to survive, but it's human nature to want more. But as we know, Jesus called to a higher standard. In the parable of the landowner was quite gracious and forthright in his management. Everyone in that story knew what the other was receiving, which created accountability. One aspect of the story to think about would be, what would change if the transactions took place behind closed doors? When we look at how wealth is earned today, we see that the average executive's corporate pay has increased 1,360% since 1980, while the average worker's purchasing power has gone nowhere, and the minimum worker's power has decreased by 32%. Debt has enslaved us, and for the first time since the Depression, consumer savings has gone negative. When we live in a land of plenty, no one is accountable to the community. Everyone takes as much as they can get their hands on. And this inequality builds violence. Looking again at accountability, one of the aspects that we have forgotten is that the word administration contains the word minister. Too often we forget that administrative executives, along with the Pharisees, are ministers. They are to be leaders demonstrating through their lives what provides justice through the hands and the feet of an organization. All of today's administrators are paid the highest salary in an organization. How does this top-down model compare to what Jesus spoke about? Many hands make light work in an executive's padded wallet. Even our Mennonite institutions, MMA, colleges, and universities, can't escape from the world's call. Each institution has employees paid over $100,000 a year with benefit packages higher than the lowest paid employee's salary. In an environment meant for service, sustainability, and peace leadership, why then are salaries higher than necessary? Some would argue that our denomination has to compete for top talent. Just look at the commercials on TV for theladders.com, which has only $100,000 or above jobs. Now, this would be true if we were running an infrastructure conforming to the exaggerated economics of the United States, but we're not. So why, again, are salaries so high? We look and go back to the fundamental human element and see that I deserve it kicks in. Just like the workers in the vineyard, we realize that we are no less selfish than the rest of the culture. Here are four questions for the rest of the presentation to stew upon. How then does this contribute to peace when we begin to expect resources and stop seeing them as a gift from God? How is this viewed in the eyes of the people we are trying to help? How does having all of this power in decision-making affect the lives of others and change communities? How can we as Mennonites justly call ourselves separate from the world because we refrain from government, but we still follow along with the world's economic practices? Because all humans participate in economics, everyone needs to be involved in decision-making. Administrative elites should have no more right to control our lives through economics than the Pharisees did to the woman. Here is a peace-building example of why we need diversity. Malaria is a large problem for sub-Saharan Africa. Peacemakers introduced mosquito nets treated with pesticide to stop the spread of disease and infection. Soon after handing out the nets, many mothers were coming back with children with unusual rashes. Upon further examination, it was determined the children were coming into contact with the insecticide. Mothers had been mistakenly misinterpreting the directions on the packaging. Peacemakers had failed to contact with local culture about the diversity in the context and how to proceed with correct packaging instructions. Now, at the root of the issue is trust. The problem was an honest mistake. But it demonstrates that peace is multifaceted, and not one person, even the peacemaker, can be ultimately right. Peacemakers, administrators, lay people, and others privileged to be in a position of decision need to work through other people. The instruction failure could have simply been resolved by networking with someone who can understand the culture's mindset. From my own personal experience living in an intentional community, we have the intention of saving money by buying cheap food and little of it. But sometimes being cheap has adverse effects. We just continue the economic cycle of violence by forcing decisions to be made through pesticides that affect the environment, the unequal pay of the workers who gather food, and the members of our own community whose physical bodies need more diverse foods, more foods for well-being. Solutions are not as simple as just using less. It requires being smarter and using trust and diversity to produce more efficiency. Two heads are always better than one. So peace becomes a communal process that not only one person can do, especially the top leader. God's gift to us was diversity, but we too often neglect this gift just as we neglect our earnings as a gift. Being more efficient renews the earth and the people whose sustenance and opportunity come from it. One last classic problem is the classic poverty trap. Willie Mae Payne, a Richmond, California resident, wants to save money on her utility bills and comply with California's carbon dioxide emissions reduction rules. She needs money to upgrade her windows, but until she upgrades her windows, she can't save money. Many financially poor Californians want to save energy, but they tend to see the economic policies set forth as a Hollywood agenda. This puts huge stress on anyone and can lead back to many forth-mentioned economic sins. But once again, from a religious context, we ask the core question of who is sinning. We see the violence and crime rates increase in areas of economic despair, and the cycle of violence, of economic violence, continues indefinitely. In conclusion, earning and spending money has a huge impact farther than what we can realize on our fellow humans. We need to hold our leaders and others accountable for how we use our resources. They are servant leaders, just like Jesus, pressing for accountability. Peace through economics starts in us and around us and extends outward to all aspects of life. Finding solutions together, we can decrease economic and structural violence and increase community and restorative justice. Like Jesus, break the cycle, put down your rock, and reach out to a prostitute. Thank you.
Well, good evening. I must say that as a Zook, being this close to the beginning of the order is a shock to me. It doesn't happen very often. May I also say, before I begin, as a preemptive defense of my own self, I'm not a biblical scholar by any stretch of the words. As a matter of fact, I'm a biologist. However, and admissions office take heed, thanks to the liberal arts curriculum here at EMU, I know a little bit about biblical history and theology. And one of my favorite figures in church history is Martin Luther. Martin Luther attempted to fix problems in the church by facing them head on, rather than coming at them from the side or insinuating to a few others in the church. He saw that certain practices in the Catholic Church, most notably the sale of indulgences, were hindering the mission of that church. And please know, I do not have anything against Catholics, but this was the situation that Martin Luther was faced with. He made his arguments public with the nailing of 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg in 1517. In terms of just sheer showmanship, you can't beat that. That takes the cake. And I'd say, despite whatever arguments we as Anabaptists may have with Luther in terms of his theology or decisions in later life, I think we can all agree that we should follow his example. When we find something inconsistent in our church, we must bring it up so that we can fix it and help our church move forward in our witness and make our church stronger. One of the wonderful goals of the Mennonite Church is to stand for peace and justice in this world. And this is a fine thing to do, and I believe it to be consistent with the teachings of Christ. Because of this goal, we in the Mennonite Church consistently work to uplift the oppressed. We work with governments, regimes, non-governmental agencies, individuals, and international organizations to encourage the cessation of hostilities, rebuild infrastructure in devastated areas, and bring Christ to those who need it. This is a fine goal, but I believe in our enthusiasm to do this, we have neglected a group of people just as deserving as of our attention, our care, and our fellowship. And if we are truly to stand for peace and justice, then we must bring our ministry to this group, perhaps above all other groups. A year and a half ago, my cousin Derek joined the U.S. Army. He was a graduate of Messiah College, which is in Grantham, Pennsylvania. It's connected to the Brethren in Christ Church, which is a peace church, very similar in many ways to the Mennonite Church. He majored in graphic design. He joined the Army in order to gain job experience, money to pay off school loans, and a second shot at the job market. He was not one of those who joined seeking adventure or who joined because he wanted to experience war. The Army made him an offer that was more attractive than anybody else made to him. If we are truly to stand for peace and justice, then we must bring our ministry to people like my cousins, because within 4 months of graduating from boot camp, he was sent to a place that he called downrange. The rest of us call this place Iraq. So how do we in the Mennonite Church interact with individuals who have joined the military? And I'm not asking how we interact with that nameless, shapeless, faceless giant in uniform, which we so often call the military. I'm asking, what do we do when we are confronted with an individual like my cousin or any of the other 2,284,698 people in the active duty armed forces or reserves? What I would really like to know is what happens when one of them would like to join our church. The interesting thing is that the message of peace taught by the Mennonite Church can change lives. My pastor told me the story of speaking to a young man, a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. And if you know anything about the people and the graduates who come from our Armed Forces Academies, they are smart people. He was commissioned as an officer. When he heard this Mennonite message of peace, within 6 months, he had resigned his commission and moved towards a life of service in the Mennonite Church. Clearly, this is a powerful message. I did some research for this talk, and I discovered that Virginia Mennonite Conference will allow a member of the military to join a Mennonite church if they do two things. First, they must be planning on or be in the process of getting a discharge from the military. They must be on their way out. Second, they must show a proper attitude of contrition and repentance. Clearly, this is a step forward from prohibiting membership of the military totally. So why do I bring this up? We in the Mennonite Church are a Christ-centered church. Because of this, our actions must line up with the teachings of Christ. The writings of our pastors and theologians, while certainly important, pastors, please don't get angry at me, must be subordinate to the teachings and laws laid out by Christ. Does our treatment of the military members when they want to join our church line up with Christ's teachings? My answer is absolutely not. Why do I say this? Because the last thing Christ said to his followers is known as the Great Commission. According to the NSRV, it states, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And remember, I am with you," "and teaching them to obey all things that I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age." This is the version from Matthew. A commission is a charge or a mission given to an individual. When a soldier is commissioned, he is given authority to carry out a mission. In the same way, Christ has given us authority to continue his mission and to take it to all people. By excluding the members of the military from our churches unless they have jumped through our hoops, we have voluntarily limited the scope of this mission. Since my cousin has joined the Army, I have been forced to change my perspective of the military. I now see individuals rather than simply a them or an it. While I do not agree with everything the military does, I now see that the individuals in the military are in need of the love of Christ and the message of peace just as much as those who live in war zones. To be sure, the rank and file soldier is a victim of warfare and injustice in ways very similar to the more traditional victims of warfare that we are so used to pitying and attempting to help. I believe that when Christ was on earth, he did not restrict his ministry to those who believed with him and agreed with him. He did not simply hang out with those who accepted his positions and allowed the others who did not agree with him yet to be neglected until they came around. Rather, he sought out those who were marginalized in the hope that his message would change their hearts. Ladies and gentlemen, by restricting the ability of people in uniform to join our churches, we're hurting our witness. And restricting our peace message. How are we to take our message of peace to the military if we marginalize the individuals who make up the very organization we are trying to change? I am reminded of the story of Jesus and the Roman centurion in Matthew 8. A centurion was a high-ranking Roman officer, who commanded 80 men. That's about the equivalent of a modern captain. Christ did not refuse to help, despite that the centurion was certainly not a pacifist. Instead, Christ commended his faith. How different is our behavior? Instead of commending the faith of those in the military and seeking to share our message of peace, we send the message that they are not good enough to be part of our church and that they must give up sin before we accept them. In fact, we are all sinners and all members of the church through the grace of Christ. This is not Christ-like behavior. In short, we require that they have undergone the conversion experience before they join, rather than allowing the church itself to convert. Furthermore, we neglect a group of people in great need of sympathy and care. The men and women of our armed forces are, by and large, not much different from me, but unlike me and you, they have experienced horrors which none of us can ever imagine without being there. In 2007, according to national news sources and sources attached to psychological research organizations, 17% of Army soldiers on return from combat showed signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and depression, as well as difficulty interacting with others. By 6 months after their return stateside, 33%, fully one-third of these soldiers showed signs of PTSD. 12% of active duty troops and 15% of soldiers in the reserves had signs of alcoholism within 6 months of returning home from a war zone. The suicide rate among soldiers is higher now than it has been for a while. In 2007, 117 soldiers took their own lives, compared with 102 in 2006. These figures force us to agree with Civil War General William T. Sherman, "War is truly hell." One of the purposes of the church is to help heal its members, yet our attempts to form a body which agrees has led us to exclude potential members who are in such great need of the type of help and care that we in the Mennonite Church are so able to give them, perhaps more than some other denominations. A sense of the love and inherently peaceful message of Christ. Frankly, if I were a soldier just returning from home and I were rejected in this manner, I would not be able to take anything this church said seriously after that. I have to ask, what are we afraid of? Are we afraid the addition of members who do not hold exactly the same view as us will dilute our peace stance? Are we afraid that these members will corrupt our youth? These are not valid reasons for exclusion. If we take the words of Christ seriously, we are to spread his message of peace to all people. And what better place to witness for peace than in the church? And how better to do it than by accepting those who are so heavily impacted by war and working with them in a safe, healing environment? Furthermore, if we are so worried that our peace witness will be diluted by the addition of others who hold different beliefs from us, what does this say about the strength of our beliefs in the first place? Do we feel that being a member of the military is such a grievous sin that one cannot be a legitimate Christian while a soldier? If this is true, we come perilously close to condemning other denominations as being unchristian. Let us not forget, all sin is the same in the eyes of God. Murder is the same as lying to our God, to our Father God. If we believe military service to be a sin and sin a reason for exclusion from the church, then by rights none of us are to be members of this body, for it is by grace that we are saved. I suspect that if we were honest, our decision to allow membership of military personnel is not based solely on any of these questions. It's rather a combination of all of them, for we are not so different from our military brethren, any of us. I don't give this speech to condemn or to lash out. Rather, in the tradition of Martin Luther, I give this speech with the intention of refining the message of this part of the church. Like Martin Luther, I wish to point out these things in church doctrine which are inconsistent with the teachings of Christ, so that the church may move away from simply being religious and become a truly Christ-following body of people. To be fair, Mennonite Church has a ministry which seeks to help men and women of the military obtain discharges. However, we of the larger church still deny these same men and women the ability to become a member in the church until they accept our views, rather than welcoming them and depending upon the message and the changing power of Christ to change their hearts. I feel this is a problem, and I hope you agree. I'm not going to physically nail this speech to the downstairs doors of Eastern Mennonite Seminary. They're glass and would shatter, and instead of making a point, I would simply look silly. Rather, I wish to nail my points to your thoughts and to your hearts, so that together we can work towards a more true witness of the peace, justice, and love of Christ. And an excellent place to begin, I believe, would be to welcome those members of our society in the military as brothers and sisters in Christ, and to view them as victims of warfare's hell in just as full a sense as the other victims we are more accustomed to mourning. Thank you.
The basic problems facing the world today are not susceptible to a military solution. This quote strikes me as slightly ironic, considering the man who said it, John F. Kennedy, was president of the strongest military power in the world. In a society geared towards an individualistic life of ease, it is little surprise that military strength and action are the first response to conflict. Military power focuses on the protection of oneself, and war is therefore an inherently selfish solution. Peace, on the other hand, involves thinking about the other person. One definition of peace is a state of mutual harmony between two groups of people. Mutual harmony requires coming together, talking together, and then working together to make sure that both groups receive what they need. Tonight, I would like to discuss the importance of meeting basic needs, how this applies to the Christian concept of peace, and how these ideas relate to the issue of immigration. The Christian concept of peace is based on Jesus' command in Matthew to love your neighbor as yourself. In this command, Jesus uses love as a verb, an action, indicating that to love our neighbor, we need to do something for our neighbor. The action of love can take on many forms, and I don't think that there's only one right way to show love. However, as a pre-med major and a prospective doctor, I immediately recognize the importance of meeting basic needs. Every human being needs food, water, shelter, health, and community. These are something that everyone has in common, regardless of your race, your religion, your ethnicity, or your culture. Conflict arises when one or more of these needs is threatened. Working to find ways to meet these basic human needs can be a way for individuals, communities, and nations to demonstrate love and create peace. In his ministry, Jesus worked to meet the essential needs of all individuals, especially the outcasts of society. Jesus healed the sick, fed the 5,000, and created a community of believers from his 12 disciples. Jesus established a role of leadership and became known as the King of the Jews. Unlike the leaders of Rome, Jesus' power was not in military strength and did not arise from violent force. Instead, Jesus developed respect from his followers by meeting their simple and their basic needs. In Matthew 25, Jesus calls his followers to do the same by explaining that those who enter the kingdom of heaven will be those that feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and visit the lonely. Jesus clearly recognized the importance of meeting the needs of all individuals and understood that such a simple action could create a strong, uniting, and restorative force. Governments are often fooled into thinking that war will lead to conflict resolution and the restoration of harmony. Violence is used as a means to establish control and change organizational structure. But war leads to death and devastation, often resulting in the destruction of economy, government, social structures, and community. Therefore, war causes farmers, construction workers, bankers, lawyers, and many more to go hungry, become homeless, and face the loss of family and community. Although war may lead to a peace treaty between two governments, actual peace in the form of mutual harmony cannot be achieved because individuals continue to suffer. Just as Jesus understood the importance of building community by offering healing and reconciliation for even the outcasts of society, we must recognize that mutual harmony is not just about two governments, but about two nations, two groups of people. True peace cannot be achieved until the necessary provisions for every citizen of both nations in conflict have been provided. Although there are many ways in which violence is threatening the basic needs of citizens of the world today, one issue that has touched me personally is the conflict over U.S. immigration policies. Although I would not necessarily consider this conflict a war, it is certainly a situation where mutual harmony is needed. From the U.S. perspective, many U.S. workers feel that their jobs are in jeopardy due to the increasing influx of immigrants. Also, some Americans feel that the safety and the comfort level in their communities are being diminished by the diversity that immigration brings. Even though most Americans are still able to eat three meals a day and have a home in which to live, the fact that some individuals feel as if their basic needs are threatened is enough to create this conflict. From the perspective of an immigrant, coming to America is often necessary to provide enough income for a home, food, and a healthy lifestyle because the resources and opportunities in their home country are lacking. Two summers ago, I had the opportunity to spend 10 days in a rural mountain village in Guatemala. There I met a man who had left his family for 3 years to come to the United States to work illegally. When this man showed me his home, I realized that unlike all the other homes in the village, he had a concrete floor, which is really important because concrete floors prevent parasitic infection. Also, this man owned a truck that allowed him to drive into the city and take other men with him so that they could work. He was a community leader because of these actions and also because he owned the only telephone in the whole village. It was obvious to me that the money he had made in the United States illegally allowed this man to better provide for his family and for his community. Seeing the conflict from the perspective of this immigrant worker helped me to realize that peace can only be restored when the needs of both the Americans and the immigrants are met. The conflicting issues of immigration became even more complicated when I investigated the reasons as to why Guatemalan or any other immigrants are not able to meet their own basic needs. The biggest problem is that the home countries of the immigrants are failing to provide the opportunity for their citizens to rise out of poverty. However, in many cases, this poverty trap is supported by American economic and political policies. One simple example in Guatemala is American-owned sweatshops. The lack of employment in Guatemala makes it necessary for citizens to accept jobs at sweatshops that pay ridiculously low wages and lead to a continuous cycle of poverty. Historically, the United States has also played a big role in the Guatemalan government by funding dictators that have supported U.S. interests. In the 1940s, the U.S. United Fruit Company was the single largest landowner in all of Guatemala, held a complete monopoly on the banana trade, and controlled all of the transportation systems necessary for Guatemalan commerce. The company prospered by supporting dictators that allowed for exploited labor and economic dominance by this American company. In 1944, the Guatemalan people overthrew this right-wing dictator and elected a democratic leader. His successor proposed the redistribution of land in Guatemala, which obviously threatened the interests of the United Fruit Company, who owned almost the entire country. In response to this threat, the US CIA organized a coup that replaced the democratically elected leader with another right-wing dictator who supported the interests of, guess who, the United Fruit Company. Although Guatemala has elected leaders since then, and the United Fruit Company is no longer in business, this is just one of many examples of how American economic and political policies are preventing Guatemalans and many other immigrants from having the ability to provide for themselves. Therefore, the threat that illegal immigration presents to American basic needs is a result of the threat that American culture and business presents to the basic needs of many immigrants. Essentially, American culture and business prevent many immigrant nations from being able to bring their citizens out of poverty, which causes the immigrants to need to come to the U.S. to look for work. The simplified reality of this situation is there is conflict because basic needs are either threatened or lacking. In order to bring restoration and mutual harmony to such a complex situation as illegal immigration, I believe the first step is to provide better opportunities for immigrants in their home countries. The United States has spent increasing amount of money on securing the borders, from hiring guards to building fences. What if the same amount of money was invested in the economies of the countries from which these immigrants are coming? What if American sweatshops began paying livable wages to their employees? What if we, as consumers, refused to buy products made in these low-wage sweatshops? Well, I recognize that you not buying one shirt made in a Guatemala sweatshop is not going to solve this complex problem. My point is that we need to be aware of where our money is going, both as consumers and as a country. From the government perspective, investing money to assist individuals in meeting their own needs would be far more beneficial than building a taller fence. If the needs of immigrant workers could be met in their own countries, they would have far less reason to come to the United States to work illegally, and the threat to American lifestyles would also be reduced. Additionally, taking the initiative to assist developing countries in meeting the needs of their people would reflect positively for the United States and hopefully strengthen international relations. While peace building often does require working with governments, signing policies, and writing treaties, the needs of every citizen cannot be forgotten. Mutual harmony cannot be achieved until every citizen is no longer hungry, thirsty, or homeless. Recognizing this fact provides us the opportunity to be peace builders each and every day of our lives. We must be aware of the basic needs of people around us and willing to provide for those needs as an act of love towards our neighbors. By being aware of how our choices and actions affect others, we create a foundation for peace and restoration in all situations. I strongly agree with John F. Kennedy's wise yet ironic quote. The basic problems in the world today cannot be solved through military strength. Instead, we must look for resolution by following the example of Jesus and addressing basic needs in order to create a basis for peace. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming. I want to begin with these words from the 14th century German monk Meister Eckhart. Know then that God is bound to act, to pour himself out into thee as soon as ever he shall find thee ready. He is obliged to act, to overflow into thee, just as the sun must burst forth when the air is bright and clear and is unable to contain itself, for it were a very grave defect in God if, finding thee ready and so bare, he wrought no excellent work in thee, nor primed thee with glorious gifts. Thou needest not seek him here or there. He is no further off than at the door of thy heart. There he stands lingering, awaiting whoever is ready to open and let him in. By the dawn of the Reformation, such overwhelming confidence in the material and spiritual generosity of God was soon to be forgotten. The intimacy between spiritual and economic life that we see in Eckhart had grown cold in the minds of Martin Luther and his fellow reformers. With the Roman Catholic Church's power withering, the reformers, considering themselves ordained to govern society, opted not to depend on God for the gifts needed to live abundantly, since this was an impossible method for managing the economy, but instead turned to the new rising merchant princes for their economic wisdom. Soon, such alienating practices as civil usury, what we call interest, once thought sinful by the church, were baptized, leaving the domain of economics safe in the sharp-edged swords of secular authority, thus launching the genesis of modern capitalism. Economics, under the guise of capitalism, according to the textbooks, is the science that studies the allocation of scarce resources, the assumption being that the created world is one inherently lacking the resources necessary for the equal well-being of its creatures. Theologian William Cavanaugh, in his manifesto Being Consumed, reveals the implications of this phenomenon. The idea of scarcity assumes that the normal condition for the communication of goods is through trade. To get something, one must relinquish something else. The idea of scarcity implies that goods are not held in common, that the consumption of goods is essentially a private experience. The doctrine of a scarce world is to capitalism as the book of Genesis is to the Holy Bible. Insofar that capitalism declares that the world was not born with plenitude, with innate scarcity and despair. It lays the foundation for the competition and violence that are the holy sacraments of capitalism. Furthermore, and most crucial, it is also the death of true gift-giving. No longer are we convinced, as Meister Eckhart once was, that God is bound to act, to pour himself out into thee and prime thee with glorious gifts. Rather, we perform the liturgy of capitalism, kneeling at the altar of the global free market, meanwhile insisting that the only gifts God gives nowadays are merely spiritual, leaving the Creator, who uttered, "Let there be light," and spoke the universe into being, silent on matters material and economic. Today's economy, which is fundamentally predicated on scarcity, is always already in an eternal state of crisis. When we are perpetually deceived by consumer culture that we do not possess enough to live abundantly, we seek to consume more, and often at the expense of our neighbor. Therefore, spinning the cycle of competition, corruption, and violence, and pursuits of dominance with no end in sight. The outcomes of this eternal crisis have been numerous and tragic, from the nuclear arms race, to the depravity of the third world, to sweatshops and the sex trade, to billionaire CEOs, the principalities and powers continue to feast at the triumphant banquet of capitalism while the multitude stands at the castle door begging for scraps. The current financial crisis with which we are bombarded by, wherever we turn, is but the latest chapter in the unfolding story of capitalism's global hegemony. At a moment of history where, as the French philosopher Jacques Derrida claims, never have violence, inequality, exclusion, famine, and thus economic oppression affected as many human beings in the history of the earth and of humanity, the present spending of our government to preserve the most destructive lifestyles in the world has ever known, indeed our own, can only be seen as pure nihilism. Lying behind its facade of freedom is capitalism's inherently competitive and violent nature. However, as any magician surely knows, the deception is what makes a good trick. But when the truth behind the sleight of hand is revealed, the audience demands its money back. Enchained by the deceit of capitalism, we evermore find ourselves wanting to break free from the cycle of violence. What, then, could grant us such an emancipation? What kind of economy could sow seeds of peace? And what would it look like? Let us return to theology. The relations of the three divine persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, form, we might say, a divine gift economy. As they dwell intimately throughout the universe, they operate only in terms of gift-giving. The universe, infinitely mysterious and created in plenitude, was fashioned as a gift. The principalities and powers of darkness, still resisting the ocean of love that is Trinity, construe the world into a wasteland of scarcity whereby ceaseless competition and violence mark the path of a capitalist disciple. Nevertheless, the history of competition, violence, and death, past, present, and future, can only be seen in light of the life, death, and resurrection of the Nazarene who lived and died as one identified with the poor and desperate, and yet was a giver of infinite gifts and called his followers to do the same. The divine gift economy, exemplified in the cross, and the second gift of life called resurrection, disrupts the capitalist mode of commerce. Like my Palestinian friends, who welcomed me into their home, gave me a seat at their table and a place to lie my head, the gift blasts our preconceived notions of poverty and wealth, re-narrating the world as one created by God in plenitude and abundance, whereby our lives and the resources that sustain them are to be dispossessed, given again and again in faith that the well-being of the many secures the well-being of the one. A gift is many things, but most importantly, It is something that must continue to move. A gift given that becomes a possession loses the properties of a gift. Thus, true gifts circulate among many parties, and their effect multiplies as it moves. Art theorist Lewis Hyde writes, "Wherever property circulates as a gift, the increased conviviality of the group and the strengthening of the spirit of increase that accompanies that circulation is simultaneously material, social, and spiritual. Where wealth moves as a gift, any increase in material wealth is automatically accompanied by the spirit of the gift." The spirit of the gift to which Hyde alludes is, finally, a spirit of plenitude and peace. As communities of faith dispossess their materials, inviting them to be used by whomever, there becomes an intentional act of hospitality. Such hospitality acts independently of the usual cost-benefit exchange central to capitalism, and makes clear that God has created the world in abundance, meaning there is enough for everyone to live peacefully, without competition and violence, if we are willing to rename our possessions to be what they truly are, that which is gift. Doing so proclaims fidelity to the divine gift economy, from which all acts of faithful dispossession and hospitality find their true source. Indeed, the gifts that we give are only made possible by the ceaseless generosity of the Trinity. Perhaps to conclude, I might suggest that peace theology and peacemaking need to be more materialistic. Faced with speaking to a world torn by competition and violence, can we continue to critique the principalities and powers, the war makers, and forms of structural violence without critiquing capitalist economics? And finally, could a gift economy be the foundation for a more robust peace theology? Let me conclude with more words from William Cavanaugh. What is truly radical is not that God rewards those who help the poor. What is truly radical is that Jesus identifies himself with the poor. The pain of the hungry person is the pain of Christ, and it is thus also the pain of anyone who is a member of the body of Christ. If we are identified with Christ, who identifies himself with the suffering of all, then what is called for is more than just charity. The very distinction between what is mine and what is yours breaks down in the body of Christ. We are not to consider ourselves as absolute owners of our stuff, who then occasionally graciously bestow charity on the less fortunate. In the body of Christ, your pain is my pain, and my stuff is available to be communicated to you in your need. Thanks.
Throughout my 4 years of study here at EMU, I've basically learned three things. One, the environmental and social problems in our world are overwhelming. Two, most of these problems are caused by unjust systems. And three, I, as a wealthy American, have benefited from these systems. Our political, social, and economic systems are simply structured to benefit the powerful at the expense of the powerless. 10 minutes is not nearly enough time to address this question, so I will not attempt to. Instead, I would like to focus on a case study. A quick look at the U.S. education system may give us some insights into the larger issue of structural violence. To begin, what exactly is structural violence? Johann Gultung, a peace theorist, defined violence as, quote, the avoidable impairment of a fundamental human need. The key here is his use of the word avoidable. If the fulfillment of a need is possible but not realized, it is avoidable and considered to be violence. Structural violence occurs when the perpetrators of an avoidable violence are not easily identifiable. As Gultung writes, the violence is built into the structure and shows up as unequal life chances. A singular person is not to blame. Instead, the broader structure is the problem. But where did the structure come from? Who created it. Paul Farmer's work, Pathologies of Power, argues that people in power create the systems, and in doing so, stack the deck in their favor. In this view, structural violence is caused by the uneven distribution of power. More simply, it means that those who make the rules win, and those who don't lose. Structural violence is threefold. It is the avoidable impairment of a fundamental human need that is caused by an indirect source and created and maintained by those in power. Does the inequality in the U.S. education system fit into this threefold definition of structural violence? First, is it an avoidable impairment of a fundamental human need? The Universal Declaration of Human Rights includes education as a fundamental human right. But is it avoidable? Can we give every kid in the U.S. an excellent education? Sweden, the Netherlands, and Finland have consistently ranked higher than the U.S. in language, math, and science proficiency, yet they spend less per student and have a lower per capita income. As the wealthiest nation in the world, resource scarcity is not the problem. We have the tools to equip every child, but we don't. At West Philadelphia High School in the city of Philadelphia, 95% of 11th graders fail to pass basic math and reading exams. There is a discrepancy between the potential and the actual fulfillment of the right to education. This discrepancy is violence. But who is to blame when a child fails a proficiency exam? The ill-equipped teacher? The overworked single mother? The, quote, stupid child? To say yes to any of these is too easy and far too simplistic. The less than comfortable answer is that the real culprit is the system. Although funding alone cannot solve inequality, the fact remains that the school system is equipping children inequitably. Schools in Pennsylvania are funded primarily by property taxes. Different communities have, of course, different property values that allow for different levels of taxation. Because of this system, wealthy communities have access to more money for education than poor communities do. In many cases, funding is not shared between communities, so over a small geographical area, there can be large differences in funding and performance. Lower Merion High School is just 6.2 miles from West Philadelphia High School. Yet close to 90% of their students are considered proficient or higher in math and reading, vastly different from the 5% of students achieving proficiency at West Philadelphia. As you may have guessed, Lower Merion is a wealthier community. Only 7% of students are considered low income, and the school board is able to spend upwards of $20,000 per year per student. Compare that to West Philadelphia, where 92% of students are considered low income, and only about $12,000 is spent per student per year. Suburban kids, like those at Lower Merion, have access to the best resources and the most experienced teachers, so of course they succeed at higher rates than students without these tools. It's all about resource distribution, and the current system simply distributes resources unevenly. Who created this unjust system, and who maintains it? In most cases, school boards, county commissioners, and local elected officials decide who gets what money. The vast majority of these people are wealthy. They have both political and economic power. Naturally, they use this power to give their kids access to excellent resources. But this is where the powerless end up with the short end of the stick. West Philadelphia does not have the political or the economic power to give their kids an excellent education. As long as power is concentrated in wealthy suburban school districts, our education system will continue to exacerbate inequality. In my experience working with kids in both traditional and alternative learning programs, I have seen this inequality firsthand. Some kids are just simply not given the tools to succeed, and then punished for their, quote, misbehavior. As a Christian, I'm outraged by the injustice of the education system and believe that faith can and should inform our response to structural violence. For me, it comes back to the command to love my neighbor. What course of action is most loving? There are two possibilities I would like to highlight. The first is based on the parable of the Good Samaritan. We're all familiar with the plot. A man is robbed and beaten. A priest and a Levite ignore him, but a Samaritan stops to help. He cleans the man up, puts him on a donkey, and takes him to an inn. The Samaritan pays the innkeeper to care for the man. In other words, he gives of the resources that he has received. As Christians who take seriously the command to love our neighbors, we must give of the resources that we have been given. In terms of education, what does this look like? Other than financial, the resources we have to offer personally are primarily knowledge and time. We can give of these resources by teaching or volunteering in a community with limited resources. Lots of programs, including City Year and Mission Year, connect qualified individuals with service opportunities in education. Mennonites have long been leaders in the field of domestic and international service. We are comfortable with the ideas and philosophies behind volunteerism and self-sacrifice. But is this enough? I would argue that service alone only addresses the effects of an unjust system, and not the causes. The cause, in this case, is unequal distribution of power in the education system. By lobbying for a different funding system, we can prevent the injustice. Mennonites are not accustomed to challenging and changing systems. Historically, we have avoided lobbying and advocating, although this has dramatically changed in the last 30 years. The fact is that creating systemic change increases conflict in the short term. Few residents of Lower Merion are going to take kindly to the suggestion that we redistribute the power and resources from their community to West Philadelphia. In this way, working to end systemic violence may necessitate deliberate agitation of conflict. Good Schools Pennsylvania is an organization that is advocating for equitable school funding. They've only been around since 2001, but they've already had some major successes. Just last year, the funding formula was altered to include parameters such as poverty. Basically, it means that schools that have fewer local resources are getting more federal funding to remedy inequality. This year, West Philadelphia High School received twice as much federal funding per student per year than Lower Merion High School. It's a small but important step towards an equitable system. These examples show that there are two effective ways to combat unjust education system. One, give of the resources that we have received through service and volunteerism. And two, lobby and advocate for equitable funding of school systems. Can these two simple conclusions lead us to broad conclusions about combating structural violence more generally? I would propose that both service and advocating for change can be effective strategies. The former is working within the system to address short-term injustice, and the latter is focused on long-term prevention. Simultaneously working within and against the system may seem contradictory, but they are in fact two necessary and interdependent efforts. There is tension between them, but it is a constructive paradox that builds on the resources of each other. If we are to do true peace building, we must address structural violence. Service and individual change is needed, but without advocacy, it is short-sighted. As Christians, we must continue to serve those around us, but must also embrace the role of advocacy in building a more just world. Thank you.
The flesh of your mother sticks between my teeth.
Excuse me. Aside from being a great attention grabber, this insult was, according to Jared Diamond, the most inflammatory taunt that could be hurled at an enemy on the remote Pacific island, Easter Island. When Easter Island was first happened upon by European explorers in 1722, they encountered a barren island inhabited by small, lean, timid, and miserable vestiges of a thriving culture that had built the world-famous Moai statues just centuries prior. Easter Islanders were not always starving cannibals, however. Nor was Easter itself barren. In fact, quite the opposite was true. Easter Island was once a thriving subtropical forest with biodiversity that supported as many as 15,000 human inhabitants on its minuscule 66 square miles. The statues they built rose up to 32 feet in the air and weighed as much as 87 tons. They were dwarfed, however, by the gargantuan basalt rock platforms upon which they stood, the largest of which weighed in at a total of 9,000 tons. The construction of these statues required incredible engineering, for which the island is rightly famous. It also required three more things: labor, provided by those at the lowest end of the socioeconomic spectrum; food, grown in on what were essentially industrial farms, away from most of the island's population centers. Surpluses of food were required to feed the thousands of workers who did nothing but haul statues from the quarry to their eventual locations. The third thing was natural resources, specifically non-renewable natural resources. Transporting and erecting Easter Island's massive statues required large amounts of both lumber, which was used to build the sleds upon which the statues were dragged, and bark, which was used to make rope. This resulted in the complete deforestation of Easter Island. Easter Island's trees were keystone that held the entire island's ecosystem together, and no matter what they may have believed, the Eastern Islanders were a part of this ecosystem. The deforestation of Easter destroyed the natural habitat of the island's original inhabitants. The animals, including six now extinct species of birds, provided the precious protein required by the islanders for survival, but had no habitat and no means of survival after the forests were destroyed. Without the 11-foot-wide trees from which they built the seagoing canoes Easter Islanders used to get there in the first place, they could no longer hunt porpoises and turtles, which were even more essential sources of protein. Without non-human sources of protein, Easter Islanders were forced to turn to each other. From Jared Diamond's collapse, Easter's chiefs and priests had previously justified their elite status by claiming relationship to the gods and by promising to deliver prosperity and bountiful harvests. They buttressed this ideology with monumental architecture and ceremonies designed to impress the masses and made possible by food surpluses extracted from the masses. As their promises were being proved increasingly hollow, the power of the chiefs and priests was overthrown by military leaders, and Easter Island's formerly complexly integrated society collapsed in an epidemic of civil war. Commoners now built their huts in the coastal zone, and for safety, many people turned to living in caves that were enlarged by excavation and whose entrances were partially sealed to create a narrow tunnel for easier defense. What went wrong at Easter Island? How could a society that was so advanced fail to understand the consequences of their actions? And what was that Easter Islander thinking when he cut down Easter Island's last tree? And even more troubling, didn't the Easter Islanders realize that once they'd destroyed their environment, they had nowhere else to go? There is no doubt, and I repeat, there's no doubt, that we are living in an era of unprecedented human-caused global warming. New research shows that sea levels could rise up to a meter by the year 2100. 91 years. A meter. The light by which I am able to read this sentence is made by electricity produced by coal that was mined by literally blowing the top off of a mountain in our neighboring state of West Virginia. There's a collection of plastic trash the size of Australia floating in the Pacific Ocean that will never decompose, but we can't see it, so we don't care. Our American lifestyle is completely, utterly, and irrefutably unsustainable. We compose less than 5% of our planet's population, yet we consume 1/4 of its energy, and we pollute accordingly. And not only is our egregious unsustainability just plain dumb, but our unsustainability is necessarily violent in every sense of the word. We have perpetrated violence against God's creation, the likes of which are unprecedented in history. And we have violated the sacred and fundamental truth that all humans are created equal in the image of God. We have valued low gas prices more than the lives wasted in the pursuit of economic and military hegemony. We have valued cheap bananas more than the lives of people who democratically elect governments that we later overthrow. We have valued the convenience of driving across town or across campus more than the old-growth forests we destroy with acid rain. Our legacy will not be democracy, freedom, or anything that begins with a lowercase I. Humankind's legacy will be its destruction of our planet and its ecosystems. Our legacy will be a carbon-saturated atmosphere that has changed our global climate, possibly causing another ice age. We have become, in short, a force of nature. We have acted with such sinful negligence so as to destroy the fragile balance of our planet and its climate, and in doing so, we have elevated ourselves to a level at which we play God, while simultaneously believing that we are completely free of any dependence or accountability to God and creation. And just like those who attempted to equivocate themselves with God at the Tower of Babel, we too shall fall. Nobody is free of guilt. Not Wendell Berry, most of all, not me. But that doesn't mean that we can't change and strive, struggle, and sacrifice to live peacefully in order to build a more peaceful world. We must live peacefully with our neighbors and our planet, and we must forsake our consumerist and militarist ways in order to confront and change the powers that be on behalf of the least among us. To do so require a courage that, as Atticus Finch said, is not a man with a gun in his hand. This is the courage of Christ, Gandhi, King, and Mandela. When we are declared subversive or unpatriotic, so be it. If we die the death of seditious revolutionaries at the hands of the state, rejoice, for that is the death that Jesus died. We will never know if anyone on Easter Island questioned the unsustainable consumption of their island's natural resources. Not questioning our own consumption in the face of overwhelming scientific and historical evidence of the consequences of those actions, however, is nothing less than a dereliction of our duty as human beings. The details of this seditious and audaciously peaceful revolution have taken and may continue to take years to develop and perfect. Until then, however, plant a garden, reduce, reuse, and then recycle. Find beauty in misshapen fruit organically grown by the farmer down the road, which proves creation's resilience in the face of human attempts to control. Protect the human rights of others as you would have others protect yours. Denounce the objectification and oppression of women. Pray in churches, mosques, and cathedrals of trees planted centuries before we witnessed them. Read banned books. Hold those you love. Subvert. Play with children. Laugh. Bike as penance. Actively resist the unsustainable sins of Easter. Practice resurrection.
Thank you, and good evening. Is peace even possible? This year, I wrote two conflict analysis papers where I looked at the root causes and sources for violence and what is being done to resolve the issues and find peace. I studied the conflict in Somalia and the India-Pakistan conflict. I found numerous resources for violence and resources to contain, to prolong the violence indefinitely. But I really struggled to find sources for peace that seemed hopeful. I was disheartened, because I came here to learn to build peace. Okay, I'm not blaming EMU or Gloria Rhodes for making me look at world conflict. Peace looks impossible no matter where you look. The occurrence of violence like that in Ethiopia and Eritrea, the Congo, Sri Lanka, Israel, Palestine, the drug lords in Mexico, the U.S. war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Pakistan. I long to see peace in all these situations. Well, what can I do? Me. Well, years ago, I thought the most appropriate role for me was to address the war in Iraq. Since that war was being waged in my name as an American, when the U.S. announced its intentions to invade Iraq, I spoke out as a member of this democracy. I sat on the courthouse steps with like-minded individuals holding up signs. We marched around our city in protest of the war. What I learned from those experiences was that I'm one of 300 million Americans. And the majority of those Americans thought the invasion of Iraq was a good idea. And they let me know it. They didn't like my peace stance. And I looked around the courthouse steps, and I saw there wasn't very many people here who agreed with my path to peace. So what am I to do? I realized, though, that those people who disagreed with peace marches and anti-war protests, they also want peace. They just have a different idea of the paths to peace. It would be easy for me to say that these people are war-loving, violent people, except that they were my neighbors and my friends. They showed great generosity on many occasions and exemplified peace building in many ways. I found it hard to understand how these loving people could be at a complete disagreement with me on the issue of war. Some of these same people show me a better, more healing path in situations that I would have chosen a destructive path. Now they were telling me the best response to 9/11 was one of war. Their path to peace included the use of military force to remove Saddam Hussein from his oppressive rule and to allow justice to be done by the people he oppressed. And this was a logical path to fulfill their big picture of peace. Now, most people alive today will tell you they want world peace. From every single Miss America contestant to the chair of the UN, from international businessmen to subsistence farmers in poor countries. So if everybody wants peace, why don't we have it? Because just like the disagreement I had with my friends over the response to 9/11, there is no one obvious path to peace. Have you ever put a puzzle together without ever looking at the lid? As you picked up the first piece, how did you decide where to put it? Let's say we even know that it is a picture of, say, nature, but is it a forest or a desert? Sunset on the ocean or over the mountains? If you pick up a piece and it's green, does that mean it goes up high as tops of trees or down low as brush? Yet you start putting it together and you get a larger picture, and you can soon start to imagine what the whole picture might look like. Just like the lidless puzzle, each one of us is putting pieces of peace together. Unfortunately, we're not all imagining the same big picture. Even if peace builders had limitless resources, one's idea of peace would not be the next person's idea of peace. If we all agreed, we would just pool our resources and build peace. But because of the differences, throwing money at peace doesn't always work. Sometimes it makes things worse. However, we can still build resources for peace and build bigger pictures of peace, even though we only have small pieces of peace. With no complete picture to reference for the puzzle, you have to reference the other pieces. As peace builders, we can reference each other and see ways that we can build peace. Okay, the puzzle analogy makes this seem really simple, and it isn't. The analogy makes it seem like you just need a place to put your ideas, and they'll fit in to make peace. But that doesn't satisfy me. Too simple. While studying theology in England a couple years ago, I had a professor named Kang San Tan. He had a good idea of how to build the peace puzzle better than just putting pieces where they seem to fit. Kang San Tan was my world religions professor. And he emphasized the importance of cross-faith dialogue in today's postmodern culture. He noticed that in the name of tolerance, we are losing authentic dialogue that can lead to growth. He challenged us to be able to articulate our beliefs and fully engage in authentic dialogue. Through dialogue, we learn not to stereotype people as war-loving, violent people the way I did. But instead, we can forge differences. We can forge our differences and create a better resource for peace. Peace builders can use this same approach. There are other peace builders out there with different ideas than yours, and different ideas of the path towards peace. You and I could be in that exact situation. We need to dialogue. A dialogue that goes beyond finding common ground, to a dialectical process of change. As peace builders, we need to build resources for peace. And I think human capital is the most effective resource for peace. People are more powerful than money. And people networked together with the goal of peace are more powerful than the biggest budget. In his book, Peace Building, John Paul Lederach argues that the middle range leadership, such as intellectuals, religious leaders, NGOs, are the most effective groups wherein to build human capital for peace. Because they have relationships with people at the grassroots and the top leadership of their society. Relationships is the key word in that statement. John Paul sees the middle range leaders as powerful because they have the ability to share their ideas, their hopes and dreams for peace with a diverse set of relationships. He assumes that people will work for peace with those they're in relationship with. And so, more socially connected peace builders will spread peace further. Through dialogue together, we can build networks for peace. As we actively search to fit our small pieces together, through dialogue, we are building a larger picture of peace. Now, starting out, I shared how overwhelmed I was about all the conflicts in the world and how I had no idea what I could do. And I'm not alone in that hopeless feeling. Edicio de la Torre shared his feelings after losing 70 land cases in the Philippines. And seeing farmers that he was working with turn into guerrilla soldiers as they lost their land. Edicio recounts the scene of their last protest in September 1969, where 200 people marched in a parade, carrying torches into the night. He lamented about their failures and how weak his band of protesters were in fighting back the darkness of the unjust land dispute. But he was encouraged to see the torch of the protester beside him. And he knew that their solidarity was visible to those around them, the same way the light from the torches pierced the darkness. I brought this puzzle with me today, and I'll leave it in the back for you to take a piece with you when you go. Take some time to think about what your big picture of peace is, and what your piece of peace might be. But don't end with introspection. Actively search for other people to be in authentic dialogue with around issues that you're passionate about. Through that relationship, you will be building human capital, both in yourself and in the other person. Okay, I admit, the puzzle is too finite of an image to describe the power of peace builders networked for peace. But in spite of its shortcomings, let's together talk about world peace. Thank you.